Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Data Scientist Show. This is Daliana. Today, we have six mini episodes where I interview data scientists talking about their struggles at work. So a few weeks ago, I organized an in-person meetup in New York called The Tired Data Scientist, where we come together, just rant about our struggles at work. So there are six data scientists who are very brave to openly share their struggles with us. We talked about how to ask your manager to protect you, how to advocate for yourself, how to align with stakeholders, the challenges working in pharmaceutical companies and the finance industry. We also talked about the challenge of breaking into data science in the current job market and how to balance our tech jobs versus content creating. I think you'll really enjoy this episode. If you like the show, subscribe to the channel, give me a 5-star review. Let me know what you think in the comments or send me a DM on LinkedIn. Hello, everyone. I'm Daliana. I'm at the Tired Data Science Meetup. And here we have Vicky. Vicky, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, hello. I'm Vicky. I'm a data scientist in technology industry.
Okay. Yeah. So Vicky, you're a manager. What kind of projects do you work on?
My team, we kind of do a little bit of everything from large language models to deep learning, NLP stuff, to experimentation, A/B testing, product analytics. Yeah, mm-hmm. A little bit of everything.
So the theme of this meetup is to talk about your frustrations. Would you like to share something with us or through this small group discussion what resonated with you?
Some of the folks share their frustration that if your manager doesn't fight for you, doesn't advocate for you, and only keeps pushing you on behalf of the stakeholders, then that's frustrating.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, that's one of the things that the group shared.
Do you think you're a good manager?
I will at least say I try to be.
Yeah.
I think it's a role very unique on the team where you sometimes have to be the advocate and the protector for the team. Sometimes you have to either teach your teammate to be able to say no, very important skill, or sometimes you should say it on behalf of them in order to protect them, protect their time, protect their energy. And you don't have to like directly say no, the word no, but you can say it in the sense of, oh, we have prioritization, we have biweekly regular prioritization that we have to do, we have a lot of planning, we already have so many things that we're already going to do. Where does this thing that you're asking for, where does that lie in this whole prioritization list? Can we figure that out together? So I think a lot of it is just building agency for yourself and your team, and then letting the stakeholders know that we have a plan too. It's not like we're just like responding and being reactive to you.
Yeah. I think you're a great manager. And is this a type of skill you developed? For example, learn how to protect your team, develop agency, and then have the confidence to say no sometimes to stakeholders?
I think it's a skill I developed as a high-level IC, a solo high-level IC for a very big product team. Like I was like the only IC for 10, 20 product managers at one time. And so if I don't protect myself, nobody else will.
Yeah.
And so over time, I just developed the skill set of, I don't know, like just say, do my own quarterly planning, like proactively have a plan for my time already.
Yeah.
So that nobody else can just come in and try to squeeze something into my time.
Yeah.
And if somebody wants to do that, I always show them, where does your thing fit into that? Let's talk about the priority and what potential impact your request might have.
Yeah.
And how does that stack up against other things on this list?
Yeah, that's a great point. And how do you maintain being collaborative versus being focused on your own project? Because sometimes you do need to deprioritize, and then you don't want your coworker to feel, oh, every time I ask her something, she says, oh, this is my priority, she doesn't help me. So how do you balance that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think really sometimes it is really the thing that comes up or the thing that they say, well, I'll be able to tie it to one of the higher priority stuff. And sometimes if it really is a good idea, maybe it is worth extending that project a bit more to accommodate that request. Yeah. So I don't think from the perspective of their feeling too much.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to protect their feeling.
Right.
If somebody comes to me and all of their requests are not very useful, then I will decline them all the time. Yeah, I just judge it by merit.
Yeah. Mm. And for the data scientists who feel they don't know how to ask their managers to kind of quote unquote protect their time or advocate for them.
Yeah.
What do you want to tell them?
I think this is a skill that everybody needs to learn. If your manager doesn't protect you, you need to protect yourself. So you need to learn a couple of topics that you can keep going back to, such as prioritization.
Corporate speaking.
I guess you can say that. If it protects you,
yeah.
It works.
Yeah. So sorry, I interrupted you. So one is route it back to prioritization, maybe team goals, right? This asks, how does it fit in the roadmap? What are some other things they can use, framework?
I try to compliment the other party on their request. I will always start from, this makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Totally makes sense. I totally understand why you would ask for that.
Yeah.
I think it would be very valuable in this aspect. Mm. However, our current focus is another thing.
Yeah.
So maybe it will make more sense to group your request with a later thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not like completely dismissing what they're trying to ask me for. I'm just trying to group it into a stack rank that makes more sense.
Yeah, yeah. And it sounds, whether as a high level IC or a manager, you have to think about your priorities or try to label your tasks preactively.
Yes.
Otherwise, you don't know how to handle those conversations. It's kind of like people say, a negotiation, the best way to negotiate is to do your homework.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your goals. Mm-hmm. And then also you want to have empathy for other people's goals. Yes. And I think those are great tips. Thanks for sharing.
Thank you. Thank you. Hopefully it can help someone. Yeah.
Great. I'm at the Tired Data Scientist meetup. And we're already tired. It's at 9 p.m. in New York.
Yes.
So, but we're going to do this. Can you introduce yourself a little bit and tell us why you're tired?
Yeah, sure. So hi, I'm Ajay Bhargav. I'm a PhD, Ajay Bhargav PhD. I'm a senior data architect at Tetra Science, which is a fancy way of saying solutions architect. And I work with the top 10, top 15 pharmaceutical companies on the planet. And we try to solve data challenges, machine learning challenges for the scientific community.
Mm. Awesome. So what's your frustration? Why you're tired?
Yeah, so I'm tired because sort of the trend that I've seen working in this industry and others that I've worked in, especially with data consumers who aren't necessarily sitting at their desk, is that majority of the data that we try to collect for data quality, for ETL, for machine learning applications, lacks context in pharma. And what I mean by that is scientists are kind of like factory workers. They don't spend their time in front of a computer, but they're expected to put a lot of attribution into the computer in order for that data to be useful for machine learning applications by data scientists. So us data scientists, we sit around and we think, perfect, if we just had that context, we'd be able to build these amazing machine learning tools for people. But what we often find is that data attribution, that context just isn't there. Mm. And it's not there because scientists don't want to put that context into the computer. They're sitting in the lab, they're writing on their gloves, they're writing on pieces of paper, maybe they're writing on tubes and things, and there's just no reason for them to put that context from their minds and into the computer. And that makes people like us really tired because we're searching for that context even though we have all that unattributed data.
Yeah.
And it's a tough challenge. It really is. And it keeps me up at night. Maybe that's why I'm so energetic about it at 9 p.m.
Yeah. So how are people currently tackle this challenge?
So I think there are a few companies, just to name drop one of them, like Recursion Pharmaceuticals, really approaches their entire data stack from the ground up to get people to attribute their data right at the point where they do the experiment. Traditional pharmaceutical companies just don't do that. They're trying to build that system in place. And yet, they still invest heavily in machine learning tooling, AI tooling, But they haven't really quite solved that data quality problem yet. And I think there's no real answer to it because there's no real forcing function for people to want to put their data quality in. Mm. The example I was giving outside in our meetup that we had earlier today is the one place people are guaranteed to put the highest quality data is when they're trying to get reimbursed for flights. If you've ever worked in a job and you've ever had the pleasure of going to a conference for some one reason and you have to submit your receipts to finance, oh, you better believe people are putting in exactly how much money they spent, where they spent it, why they spent it. And that's great metadata. Those data sets end up being high quality data that we can use to track things like people spending and maybe try to reduce that. But the same is not true for scientific data. There's just no reason for people to attribute their data, add metadata that's germane to the experiment because there's no incentive. There's no audit. Mm-hmm. There's no incentive to do so. I tend to think that there needs to be a carrot, not a stick, but it, you know, it's a tough problem. It's just unsolvable, I feel. And that's what makes me tired about it.
Yeah. What are some other things you feel resonated with a small group?
Yeah, I think the other sort of general problem I saw that definitely resonates with me and my background is in science and then machine learning and then solutions architecture is that increasingly data science feels transactional. It doesn't feel like the product, which is kind of the opposite to the way that we were sold into the profession, right? Yeah. We would think that, oh, hey, we're here to make data science for companies. We're the product. We're selling the thing. Actually, we're not. We're just selling a small transaction that helps make the product better. Mm. And there's nowhere that I feel that's not only true, but kind of almost cynical is in pharma, because we're there to help. We're there to create data science tools to help drugs exist. But once that drug exists, it's there. There's no need to improve that drug. In fact, the incentive is to make different drugs because those are the ones that are going to have new intellectual property.
Yeah.
So I found in my career as a data scientist in these companies is everything I was making was just for a very specific purpose at a very specific point in time, but it never had the longevity to improve itself over time. Mm. Where I found a lot more satisfaction in doing that was in companies whose product was the data science. Mm. And those companies tend to have very strong ML ops focuses.
Yeah.
Whereas other companies like in the pharma space, they're getting there, but it's going to take time.
Yeah. So you see a lot of one-time script.
One-time. Like, I've even seen a lot of scientific posters, publications where the model is the publication. I mean, that seems kind of silly, right? Like in other industries, like why would the model be the publication? But the model is the holy grail of what they're pursuing when actually the model is just the starting point, especially if you want to build real data science products. Mm-hmm. So yeah, maybe it's a maturity thing. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't have an answer to that. This meetup just create a space for us to talk about our challenges.
Yeah. I think that meetup was super important because, and this is just a thing about New York, right? The reason I live in New York, even though the majority of my industry is in Boston, is because I find great satisfaction from talking to data scientists who live and work in other fields. Like here, the biggest representation is actually finance. So you get a lot of cross-pollination of ideas from finance and tech in biotech. And I use those ideas to then go back to the people in Boston to help them build their products. So I think it's really good to sit in a place where there's a lot of cross-functional expertise. Maybe that's why SF is also very popular, but I'm in New York. I like New York. I like my bagels. I can't seem to get enough of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, this is the last interview. We're probably the last two
people here.
People on the floor. What do you think about this meetup? Any feedback?
I think it's great. I think a very sort of like intimate forum where people got to talk openly about their problems, openly about what drives them, what keeps them back. It's super useful. Maybe it's because many data scientists work remotely. I'm not really sure how it works, but maybe people just need a catharsis. They need a place to vent.
Yeah.
And this was a great place.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. No, thank you for organizing it.
Yeah, so happy to bring so many data scientists together. So do you feel lonely sometimes?
Yeah, I think working online, it does get a little isolating. When I used to work in an office, I felt like there was a lot more bouncing back and forth of ideas. Actually, I'm a stronger advocate for in-person work than I used to be.
Okay.
But maybe there's a place for just having these kinds of forums more openly.
Mm.
Maybe that's why work societies have become a big thing. Like here in New York, we've got societies where like people sign up and go to chat about their work.
What is it?
There's one, I think it's called Clockwise. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, but
okay.
Yeah, there's like societies where people go and like just chat about work and
oh, wow.
pay to get in, which is kind of yeah. silly to me, but you know, that's a thing here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool. Well, it was great talking to you and thanks for sharing your frustrations. I'm at the Tired Data Scientist Meetup and I'm in New York and Rashad, join me again. I don't know if I'm going to do this before or after we publish this episode, so you might need to reintroduce yourself.
Okay. What if I'm too tired to introduce myself?
Oh, right. This is the Tired Data Scientist. Sure. We don't have to introduce you.
Yeah, so I'm Rashad Nieves-Becker. I am AVP Data Science at MetLife. It's my job. I like help co-lead the global AI function. So we have a globally distributed team doing tons of projects. So I focus on trying to mature the data science practice and make us ready for new emerging technologies, especially Gen AI and things like that. In practice, it means a lot of meetings, a lot of thinking really hard about fundamental problems, which is what I like about it. Also lots of presentations and slides. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I found ways to enjoy all that stuff. So it doesn't feel like, oh, I'd rather be coding. As long as you treat it in a way that tickles the same things that coding and hands-on ML did. So
you were in a group with a few other data scientists talking about their frustrations and what made them tired. Can you share what resonated with you?
Yeah. So they're both the people who are looking for a job. The most draining part is the job search. People tended to find it more draining if they just sprayed and prayed their resumes, meaning they just applied to lots of jobs and hoped that one would get back to them. They tended to find it less draining if they thought of it as a networking challenge and mm-hmm. sort of reached out to people and had conversations and sort of were more strategic about it. You're doing less outreach per day, but the outreach is of higher quality and it compounds. You're building relationships that could lead to things later or new connections or just learning new stuff, especially if you're entry level, really important. You learn lots of stuff you won't learn in school through informational interviews and interviews. So definitely do it in a way that gives you energy. So, and if you approach it in a way that drains energy, you're going to hate it every time you need to look for a job. And that is not a good position to be in because as you age, your energy will go down. Very likely.
Yeah.
it doesn't have to, but most people's at some point does. Yeah. So just statistically, you want to do it in a way that doesn't totally drain you and you totally hate it. So that every time you have to look for a job again, you hate it. You gotta look for it in a way that you're like, okay, I'm kind of like getting something out of this. Like I don't feel so bad. Like I enjoyed my day. And generally that's more like network conversation, learning focused approach, right?
Yeah.
So that was one thing. The job search is draining. If you have visa stuff, it's even more draining because there's a time limit.
Yeah.
I can imagine. I don't know what that feels like, but that must suck. Yeah. And then if you have a job, so three of us were like more senior level, two of us managing teams, one a principal data scientist. And what's one thing we all agreed upon that was really draining is meetings, having lots of meetings. But the actual larger context of that is context switching.
Yeah.
Context switching ends up being a huge drain, whether you're a principal engineer and you have to switch between a bunch of code bases every day, or you're a people manager, you have to switch, you're in a lot of meetings, you have to switch like the problem you're thinking about. Context switching is like a big thing. I'm probably going to write something on this soon because I realize what a fundamental challenge it is.
Yeah.
So that is really draining. There are ways to reduce the challenge of it, but it is always draining because your brain, it takes like willpower, decision-making power, mm-hmm. and that's finite. I don't know if it's literally like the glucose available in your brain, but over time, you experience decision fatigue. And when you're more senior, the decision fatigue is more intense because you have to make more decisions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was like, that was something that resonated with me, with the folks who had jobs. But again, I think they're solvable problems. They're solvable, but they're tough.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was in another group. So their complaint was, whenever they finish a project, send a report to the managers always, oh, there's one more thing. Can you change the font? Can you do another analysis? What if this happens? Or what if that? It never ends. Always so many follow-up questions. So as a manager, how do you deal with those situations? How do you make sure you don't drain your team like that?
I try to train the team to anticipate what I want. And by this, I try to give the team the reason behind why I want what I want. Mm-hmm. Instead of keeping it to myself. It sounds obvious, but if you talk a lot about the motivation behind it in the larger context of the problem, then it gives them the freedom to come up with ideas you didn't think of or you didn't think of until they show you something. That's one thing. Another thing is that fundamentally, like, you won't know someone who comes up with requirements won't know exactly what they want right away.
Yeah.
In the same way that no one knew they wanted a car until they saw one. And then the horse all of a sudden was like no longer a thing. It wasn't instantaneous, but you get the idea. People don't know what they want. They have goals, get places or communicate with people, but they don't know they want a car or a telephone until it's invented, right?
Yeah.
And in the smaller scale, that's like you at work coming up with your dashboard or a model or something. People have to see something and then they have to iterate on it. And in fact, the iteration is kind of the point. I mean, that's like the principle behind Agile, right? Which is iterating with your actual users on a real product, that's something that delivers value. Mm-hmm. Now, if they constantly are switching what they say they want, it's not your fault. It's actually a sign of a bigger problem. That problem is unclear priorities. So in order to fix that, you gotta like actually be the one to ask them, well, what is the priority? And if you use this, what do you actually want to do with it? And then what's the roadmap? And you ask these kinds of questions to make them think ahead now, not think ahead when you show them the dashboard next. So my general solutions, force them to think ahead by asking them, one. Two, understand the reason and motivation behind why they're asking for what they ask for. Yeah, that would take you a lot of the way there. And maybe three, something like force them to ask what's good enough. And then you like write it down. So you want to be like clear.
Yeah.
What would be good enough?
This is our contract.
Yeah. Again, though, like people won't know. So yeah, you should expect some iteration.
Yeah.
Having no iteration is usually a sign that they don't actually care. They're like, oh, thanks. All right, whatever. Or it was like a one-time deal and then your work doesn't compound.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, you by doing these things with them, your stakeholder will stop viewing you as like just someone who takes orders and does stuff like the tech person and will start to view you as a trusted partner. And that is the ultimate goal, because then they'll take their bigger projects to you. They will take their ideas and bring them to you first. And the trusted partner is the ideal position to be with your stakeholders.
Yeah, I feel like we could have a whole episode to talk about how to be a trusted partner. And I like that idea. And for the data scientists who are feeling tired, what else do you want to tell them?
Sleep more. Stop texting. Get off your damn phone.
But finish this episode before you do that.
All right, fine. It's past my blue light time. I'm sorry, I can't do this.
Thanks, Rashad. It's always great to have you back.
Yeah, thanks.
And we have Hannah.
Yes.
Hannah and I met at a party in San Francisco before, and now it's great that we're meeting again in New York. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you identify as a tired data scientist?
I would say I am a recent grad. I did my undergrad in cell biology and then did my master's afterwards in like data science. It was biomedical data science, where I applied computer vision applications to medical imaging. Mm. I was at NYU, and then after I graduated, I got my first role as a data scientist at Bank of America. And so I am recent. I realized when I went through and talked to most people, I realized that I am pretty much a little bit more ahead than most people because I am not actively job searching, but I think I am very tired in the space where in a non-tech company, the infrastructure is relatively old and I have to touch a lot of legacy code, and it's the business of the bank is to always go into like sales or trading or investment banking. You're trying to make a company IPO. And so it doesn't feel like engineering is first and foremost for the company. And I think that's where it gets tiresome because there's around 550 contractors on my team. And sometimes they do their work and they kind of just do it partially. And
yeah,
it ends up coming to me, and it just, yeah, I have to work on making sure that why these error codes are there and trying to fix all of these CI/CD pipelines.
Yeah,
it's not optimal.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's also something that you had to go through.
Yeah, so I worked at Amazon, and as a tech company, you probably think everything is perfect, but it's not. We definitely have more standardized internal tools, but for each organization, sometimes you have to build your own pipelines. I haven't worked at other big tech companies, so I don't know how to compare them. But at least I would say technology is a priority, right? Most people are software engineers and data scientists. So I could see maybe you feel like a second-class citizen working fintech?
Yeah, that's definitely what I got. And I think that's like the sentiment that most people get, especially because I think I've met, at least in my small group, most of the data scientists were all coming from different fields.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or I guess data science adjacent fields. Mm-hmm. So like in statistics, economics. And so, yeah, I think they also understand that sometimes if they're not in a pure tech company like Amazon, they feel like they're second class citizens.
Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes if you are a engineer or data scientist in a tech company, you sometimes just feel like you're working on an internal tool to support another team. You're not directly contributing to a business problem. And the benefit of working for a specific industry is you gain a lot of domain knowledge. I would say my question is, what is something you enjoy working in fintech?
Oh, wow. So I have to take a positive aspect on this.
You don't have to. I'm just curious. Because you say you stay there for a long time, right? Is it the reason you stay there mostly because you feel it will help you grow your career faster?
Well, I've been at the bank 1.5 years. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's as long as most people. I think when I graduated, it was September 2022. And so when I went to most tech companies, they were doing hiring freezes. And 3 months later, there are a bunch of waves of layoffs. And I think one of the things that I'm most grateful about is the lack of layoffs. And maybe not in the investment banking side. There were a lot of layoffs there. Mm-hmm. But at least it was not as public as others.
Yeah. So better job stability.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially as a new grad, that financial security was really appreciated.
Yeah. What are some other things? We can go back to the negativity. What are some other things you feel frustrated about?
I'm not sure. I feel most people who stay at a bank end up, even in like investment banking side and people who are in sales and trading, people come from pure engineering backgrounds, from wanting to work at NASA, and then they suddenly end up here. And I think if you do go up the chain of finance, the money becomes very rewarding.
Yeah.
Yeah. The money is, maybe not compared to like hedge funds, but when it comes to like sales and trading and investment banking, the bonuses become big when the market is more volatile. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess that's a positive aspect. But also, the market hasn't been volatile. So, our bonuses weren't big.
Yeah. So, for the data scientists who also feel tired, what do you want to tell them? or would you want to share?
I think it's the more people that I talk to, I realize that we all come with a hefty amount of imposter syndrome. And I think the one thing that I want to like share is that we all come from different backgrounds, and the fact that we have different domains of knowledge is what makes us special, not something that keeps us as outliers.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think you always have to learn new skills as you go. No one is know-all in data science, so there's no need to feel you're a faker. It just means you're learning. So thanks for sharing that. And I also use the domain knowledge from the industry you come from as a strength instead of thinking of it as a business, because you can learn technical skills anywhere. But the industry knowledge, for example, now a lot about banking, I think that would be a very unique combination skill set for your finance and data science.
Yeah. I think especially for students out there, I think it's very important to just go out and do it. Because no matter how long you're in school, I feel like you still end up using those same skills, and that imposter syndrome doesn't ever go away.
Yeah.
No matter what room you're in, you're going to be like, oh, I don't think I'm good enough. But you just keep going and you keep learning new things.
Yeah, I think I was in a discussion group and everyone there says, I have imposter syndrome, or I feel I worry being fired when I wake up when I just got hired in the job. So everybody feel the same way. Probably the people in the same room, in a same meeting room with you also feel the same way. So yeah, thanks for sharing that. I'm here at the Tired Data Scientist Meetup and I'm interviewing a few data scientists sharing their struggles. So do you want to introduce yourself and tell us what you do and then what you feel frustrated about?
Well, my name is Jonathan. And I am currently in the middle of studying to be a data scientist, kind of freelancing studying. I did attend a boot camp before, but now I'm just kind of on my own, navigating the job market and trying to break through data.
Mm-hmm. And what's your biggest frustration right now?
I'm glad I had the opportunity to be able to share these frustrations because there may be other people out there who are in the same situation as myself. Mm-hmm. So I am, like I said, navigating the job market, and it's a bit frustrating knowing that the requirements to get a data science job is drastically changing always. And the bar just kept getting higher and higher. Because I remember when I first started studying data science in 2022, you just needed a bachelor's degree during that time and some data science knowledge. Mm-hmm. But during that time, I didn't have a bachelor's degree, but I did have data science knowledge. So I ended up going back to school to get the bachelor's degree. But now as I'm doing all my searches to be a data scientist, now a lot of the requirements are masters and PhDs. Mm-hmm. So it's such a change in a short amount of time. I mean, I got my bootcamp certificate in September of 2022. So it's only March of 2024, which is not realistically 2 years yet, like fully 2 years yet. And yet these type of goals have already kind of expanded.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a bit, but I'm not giving up. And I hope that others who are in a similar predicament to me, or similar predicament to mine, also don't give up and continue to study, because data science is a very fascinating field.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing. And so by not giving up, what specifically did you mean? What kind of action you're taking, or like how do you cheer yourself up?
Well, I mean, I don't know if there's any cheering up in this process, but I try my best to study every day in a structured manner and also try to be disciplined in what is changing with the job applications and the requirements that people are looking for. So I try to provide a system in which allows me to bridge the gap between the skills and what companies are looking for. A lot of the time I kind of spend my days brushing up on my foundations of data science techniques and NLP or recommendation systems and things like that. Also trying to be more of a generalist because I like the generalist type situation because I get bored pretty easily. So I try to touch all fields of data science. And I think that to be a data scientist, just my personal opinion is you should know all aspects of data. So I study things from data analytics. I study things from data engineering because data science can't be done unless you have great data to work with, right? So I want to be the all-in-one, although that's kind of impossible because
I don't feel like it's possible,
but I'm trying my very best. But I would like to be kind of the all-in-one, the person who could take things end-to-end, starting from messy data, being able to clean it up, being able to get the insights from it, and then being able to effectively do predictive analytics in the future on it, right?
Yeah, that's awesome. So, well, if you think about where are you at right now? Maybe 5 or 10 years ago, you thought it was impossible.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. I've come a long way and I've made it this far. So I just want to keep pushing forward to eventually I reach my goals. And I feel like once I get the first one, then it becomes easier from there. So the hardest part is just the first one.
Yeah. And then maybe after a few years, you tell me you did a impossible.
Yes. I would like to come back one day as a data scientist or somebody in the data field and sit on this couch again with you and just say, hey, look, I came this far. So I wanted to have this conversation kind of as a starting point or as an inspiration to others who are in a situation like myself, who may feel down or may need more push to just keep going, because eventually you'll get to where you want to be. And that's what I'm hoping for, at least. That's what I tell myself every day. So, yeah.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. And looking forward to talk to you again.
Yeah.
And here we have Ilya. Ilya, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us why you are here, what makes you tired, what frustrates you?
I work in AI as a consultant. And I wanted to see what to get more connected to the data science scene in New York. And also meet like-minded people and voice my frustrations of the work as well as like just the work culture. And so thanks for having me.
Yeah. So can you tell us more about your frustration about work and culture?
Yeah. So with work and then something that I'm also doing on the side that is tied to like how my work is going is I'm a beginner content creator posting on AI and technology and how it helps people in their daily lives. And Dalian has been an inspiration. She's been doing it for some time and posts on AI. And so apart from my day job, doing the content creation has also been a little bit tiring, but inspiring at the same time in terms of after work and then also before work, have to think about content ideas and then posting and then also reacting and commenting, engaging with people on LinkedIn. So that has been exciting, but also tiring at the same time. Always think about content. I don't know how it is for you, but maybe you plan out your content a lot more. But as a beginner creator, I've been posting daily for almost a month now. And so,
okay, that's awesome.
So very recent.
Yeah, I think when I started, I probably posted once or twice a week. Mm. And later, I started to post once a day while I still work at AWS. And sometimes I plan, but it's also hard to plan. I later know I'm just not a planner. Sometimes I have an idea I'll write today and then maybe I have 3 ideas. I will plan a little bit. Right now, I think it's a combination of planning. For example, if I collaborate with a company promoting an event, I need to plan for that. If I just heard something interesting, for example, after this meetup, maybe I can post something. I would say there's no right and wrong way to do this. Figure out what works best for you. And also maybe you can notice what type of content creation drains your energy, what gives your energy. So maybe you can be less tired. You also mentioned the work culture. So do you want to rant something about that?
I think just with work, since I do a lot of context switching with like working in AI in terms of planning architecture and web architecture as well, but then also doing a lot of like program management, project management work. So there's a lot of meetings, and then there's a lot of coordination with chats, but then also context switching with getting more details, working on the technical stuff. So having that balance has been challenging. And communicating with different stakeholders who have the different needs. And so managing that has been challenging. And I still work fully remote, which it's, I do like that lifestyle, but sometimes you do overwork as well. Especially since I work with people in different time zones, you have to be a little bit more available sometimes. So that can be tiring.
Yeah. So what drives you? What kind of motivates you to still do this work?
Well, I've always been a fan of technology. I definitely believe that it is for the advancement of society, for betterment for humanity. So as the new tools come out, even though there is a concern with, especially with AI, with a lot of fears going on, but I still believe that it can be good for us as humans. Mm-hmm. So I am passionate about technology, and so that's always exciting. And the rapid nature of how things change is, You're always learning something. So I do love that aspect about technology.
Yeah. And for our audience who are also frustrated with, for example, context switching or remote work, what do you want to tell them?
So I think with that, and a lot of people are used to this from the pandemic, and I guess less people are working fully remote, but still it's just managing your time. There's the work-life balance is really, for me, the best things that I've found is like making time blocking my balance. Is like I do morning walks. I make sure I do that before I touch my phone or look at a computer. That way it just helps. And that's like a meditative thing. And then I get to work, and then you know, I take breaks. Afternoon, I take breaks. And then at night, I don't like, I make sure I'm off the clock I get all my tasks done. If there is something that comes up with an emergency, I do check my phone here and there, but generally all the big tasks are done before that. So you still have to manage your work-life balance, and especially with the stuff that is healthy for you, like having some type of exercise, some type of meditation, some type of family time or social time. That's still important. With the work, with the in-person, in-office work, that's a little bit more structured, but with the remote, you have to force it on yourself more so.
Got it. Thanks for sharing, Ilya, and great meeting you in person.
Likewise. Well, thank you very much, and look forward to more of your content.